It's a studio movie so unbelievably bleak that its stunning, downer ending only got approved by accident. And yet, because apparently we were going through some things in 1995, Seven spent 4 weeks as the number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America.
Movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Hi, I'm Sean Collier. This is the number one movie in America. I'm joined, as always, by the Wet Bandits of Pittsburgh-based movie podcasting. It's Camila Adams.
I was hoping you would use that.
And Robin Hitchcock. Which one of you is which?
I think Camila is Joe Pesci.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I feel like you could pull off the swearing without swearing way more than I can. And I'm the kind of idiot who'd say, maybe he committed suicide.
No, I've had 2 years of training of trying to swear, of swearing without swearing now at this point.
Motherhood.
Exactly.
We failed to acknowledge two important landmarks last week. One is that we were doing this, and it is the 30th anniversary of Home Alone.
Ah.
Very, very close to the original release, in fact, as we were recording. So happy birthday, Home Alone.
We could have had a party. We could have had cake. Well.
And we failed to acknowledge that that was our episode number 69.
What the hell? We're falling down. Bush League, guys. Bush League. Mm-hmm.
I have a little addendum to that. Why does Catherine O'Hara realize that Kevin is missing? Colin says, and I didn't have time to go check this, but he says that he thinks that she is counting passports.
Okay.
Was Kevin's passport in the beginning of the trash?
Was his passport in the trash or was it the ticket?
Yeah.
Oh.
It was his passport in the trash.
Okay. All right. I'll allow it.
Yeah, it's acceptable to believe that she just forgot how many children she had for a while because that was a hectic day. I can see it happen before. Like, where's the shitty one who was really awful last night? Like,
right. That's right. I banished him to the attic.
That's the guilt. The guilt is this happened because I kind of wanted it. This is there's right. A little bit of like.
Oh, before we I guess before we get into this one, too, I guess we can do a shout out before we forget. Like, Brad Pitt's birthday was this past weekend, apparently. So
how old is he?
57, I think.
Dude.
Yeah. So.
Man, Botox.
I hate to just shut out really obvious celebrity tweets that worked, but I know it was his birthday because Shania Twain tweeted, okay, today I'm a little impressed.
That's cute.
I like it.
And last week, we did not acknowledge Macaulay Culkin with the tweet of the year. Want to feel old? I'm 40.
I know, right? It's like, dude, what? And then, which also, I mean, it doesn't really make me feel that old. I'm just kind of surprised that he's only 4 years younger than me. I kind of assumed that he was much younger.
I definitely thought we were the same age.
Yeah.
And I'm 36.
Yeah, okay.
Because he was such the famous kid
when I was
specifically
a kid.
Robin and I were children.
Right.
You forget that he was in movies before. He was in Uncle Buck. This all started with Uncle Buck. Yeah.
Another glorious film.
Well, what a transition. other than
happy holidays. Traps,
that's the segue.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this is our Mank episode. This is our tying into the fact that David Fincher has a new movie, which doesn't happen all that often. And we get to sit back and go, oh, you have watered yourself down, haven't you, sir?
Yeah, this movie is, I mean, shit. It's,
it's, and you chose it.
I know.
Hey,
no,
podcast over. Thanks for listening.
I mean, it's bleak as fuck.
Yeah.
But it's still like, as I was watching it, I just still feel this charge, like I'm just like, you know, because I had to like stop a couple times to watch, and then I was getting to the point where they're taking the ride with John Doe, and I was like, nope, I have to stop and save it because I want to sit and watch that whole thing. Like, I don't want to stop in between it, so I got to wait and come back to it. Like, it's dark, it's we'll get to it. But yeah, I mean, it's still like, I gotta say, it's just like one of my favorites.
I think that, well, maybe we should, let's summarize it first.
Yeah.
And here to do that, as we mentioned last week, usually whenever something really dark and disturbing is happening.
Poor Robin.
It's Robin's. You know, there's two people on this podcast who will watch any dismemberment that you can throw at us. And Lord. Then one who, while a hardy viewer, would prefer not to see such things. And Robin's the one that ends up having to detail the gruesome movies. So yeah. In keeping with that tradition.
Also, I used to just do these on the fly, and then that got me too stressed out. And so I started to prepare them and practice them, and my life was so much better. Well, I just straight up forgot that I was supposed to be doing the recap today until I sat down and looked at my notes.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So back to improv, baby.
All right.
I mean, hey, it's on your resume.
Right. That's all that training for nothing.
I thought that you had not prepared because it was just too much. But, you know, I'm glad it was an accident.
Yeah.
Well, let's see how it goes. Here with a 60-second recap of Seven is Robin Hitchcock. And go.
Okay, Morgan Freeman is Detective Somerset, and he is retiring from the police force in some ambiguous Gotham-type city. And Brad Pitt is coming to replace him. They're spending 1 week together, like, training each other or whatever. And they argue about whether or not the world is good. They find a guy who was forced to eat spaghetti until he died. And then they find a lawyer who had to cut off a pound of his own flesh next to the words gluttony and greed. And they're like, ah, serial killer. And then we go through all the seven deadly sins. Morgan Freeman goes to the library. Apparently the feds look at your library records. Kel Horer. And then Kevin Spacey is the serial killer. Somebody gets fucked to death with a knife. Somebody gets her face cut off. There's the guy who's sloth and he's in a bed for a year and he's still alive. And then anyway, they go to the desert. What's in the box? It's Gwyneth Paltrow, who was Brad Pitt's wife's head.
Well done.
Yeah, that was less than a minute. I do not necessarily believe that someone unfamiliar with Seven gets it now, but in the spirit of the thing, yeah, sure, we'll count it.
It was good on the fly. You should be able to Thanks. Just...
Yeah, thank you for saying Gotham-esque, because I wrote down, what kind of double Gotham is this? Like, I know that this is, you know, that New York used to be a scarier place, and that there's plenty of crime in plenty of places, but, like, when they're talking about, like, people get murdered here every minute. A man got mugged and they stabbed him in both eyes for no reason. People are dying every... And there's literally a body bag in every scene. It's like, where do you people live?
Right.
What's happening?
Yeah, I wasn't clear
also,
if it was supposed
to... the West Coast.
Really?
So it's filmed in Los Angeles. I got distracted by this yesterday because it was like, when you've seen a movie multiple times, you know how sometimes you're like, well, I'm going to be hyper-focused on something this time.
Right.
And for me, this time, it was, what is wrong with this city? Possibly because we recently watched Batman Returns.
Right.
Sure.
And in my memory, this movie was literally set in Philadelphia for some reason. I believed that to be true. According to the internet, it is ambiguous, and it was all filmed in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I don't think of Los Angeles as looking like
not at all.
But then they're in the desert a short drive away, which is why I say this Gotham is allegedly on the West Coast. Unless they were in that car for a week.
That's like the most awkward road trip ever.
I mean, that could have been a really dry field. I don't know. The screenwriter, what the hell is his name?
Grimsey McBoo.
Yeah.
Andrew Kevin Walker.
He said that this was directly inspired by years living in New York, so, but it's deliberate that it not be clear. It's almost European, and it's like, we're going to create a world so bleak that even workaday cops must consider their existential place in the universe.
Right, seriously, for like Morgan Freeman's character, for Detective Somerset to just be like, you know what, I'm done. I don't understand the city anymore. I don't like this life. And I'm just, and I was always confused as to what city it was, but never really delved into it. But yeah, this screenwriter, he does have some pretty bleak shit on his resume. Like 8mm, that stuff hit me hard.
I've like mentally repressed that movie.
Yeah.
I was like so upset watching that movie that I was like, all right, into the vault.
Right. Have not seen 8mm.
That is
not exactly a ringing endorsement.
No, don't, it's okay. What? It's fine.
Also, that's the thing. Camila said last week that she was surprised that I was like, oh, cool, I'm excited to watch this. Like, this is so not my kind of movie. And it's just so well done.
Right.
It's impossible to not enjoy. That might be the wrong word. It's
appreciate,
impossible to not respect this movie.
Right.
Well, let's get into the fact that audiences clearly agreed because they showed up.
I was stunned that you said that this was number one for 4 weeks. And also, you're going to have to explain this whole they tricked the studio into letting it end this way thing because that's news to me.
Yeah, both of those subjects and more here in the Faxy segment. Seven was released September 22nd, 1995, the 22nd number one movie of the year. Won its opening weekend with $13.9 million. At the time, that was the largest opening weekend gross for a movie released in September, taking that record from Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. Robin, September used to be a bit of a dead zone.
It was second biggest dumping ground of the year after January.
Summer's over. We're not getting to holiday
Christmas
stuff. And
right.
Right. Second place that week was softcore favorite Showgirls, which that very weekend posted the best ever weekend gross for an NC-17 rated film. That is a record that stands today, but that only means $8.1 million in second place. And as mentioned earlier, yes, Seven was a surprise four weekend winner. On the one hand, not a lot came out. Some of the movies that it held off included Halloween 6, Devil in a Blue Dress, Assassins, Dead Presidents, How to Make an American Quilt, and Jade. So, there's not a big hit in there. If you had scheduled something major, Seven wouldn't be a four-weekend winner. But because it was kind of a dead zone, it was a surprise big hit. Frankly, outgrossing Showgirls had something to do with it because Showgirls was the talk of the town at that time, and it couldn't make it to number one because people liked Seven too much. People just kept going for a month.
Camila, what's happening with your face right now?
I was just trying to recall. I don't think I saw this in the theater. I think I saw it. It was on VHS when I finally saw it. And I was just also kind of thinking that how did it last so long? It was a number one movie for four weekends and it lasted so long. And I didn't see it until it got to VHS. I'm just confused as to how I was able to be saved from the spoiler of the reveal. You know, because it was
1,000% spoiled by the MTV Movie Awards.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I have a Mandela effect situation where I think that there is a shot of the head in the box because they show a shot of the head in the box in the MTV Movie Awards sketch.
Oh.
Are you thinking of the semi-subconscious Fight Club style images?
Right.
That's what's tripping you up?
The flash of her face,
which I feel is
unnecessary.
I wonder if it exists on the internet. Mm. It's very much they had a beautiful bust of Gwyneth Paltrow inside of the box.
I mean, to be clear, that's why it's a four-weekend winner. Why a movie this dark got to so many people is not something I can explain to you. Brad Pitt was hot? I don't know.
Yeah, I think I think that has a lot to do with it. Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, I feel like, had a lot to do with it. And also, I think Brad and Gwyneth were together when they filmed it. And, that morbid curiosity of, real live lovers played, yada, yada.
Right. I just remember I was in middle school when this movie came out. And I remember people gossiping about it and being in this movie, somebody gets fucked to death with a knife strap on. And that's how I learned what strap ons are.
First of all,
hell of a way to learn.
Yeah, right. That's
right.
This is the first viewing that I've actually been able to see what that was. I've probably seen this movie about 10, maybe 15 times in its entirety. And I always had a really, disproportionate theory of what it was actually, and then I paused it.
like you looked away, or that you
no,
didn't...
I just didn't see, and I don't think it ever really occurred to me, or that I felt brave enough to just pause it and look to see what it was. It's just always there's only show you maybe two or three quick shots of it, and so my brain, the proportions of it, the mannequin threw me off that it was. So I thought it was I thought it was a thing, a strappy thing, like a sleeve on a dick. Uh-huh. With just a tiny knife on it, is what.
No, it's a giant sword.
I was, when I paused it, I just was like, I was floored.
I want to say I quickly Googled the MTV parody involved William Shatner's head in a box. The thing that I'm thinking of with Gwyneth Paltrow's perfect head in the box, perfectly preserved. Maybe that was SNL. I don't know. Listeners, if you also remember what I'm talking about, please share.
It's for sale on Goop right now, whatever it is. They've shaved it and they turned it into a thing you rub into your butthole.
Handled it. This smells like my severed head.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad we got the lust kill out of the way, buried in the middle of the faxy segment, because I don't like thinking about it too much.
I think the worst part of it, though, is that he made somebody else do it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you have to think both about dying that way and also killing someone that way.
Right.
Admittedly, I'll call that the second worst part of it. Behind the dying.
Yeah. I mean, because all of the really bad stuff in this movie happens off screen.
I love
right?
it. That's... Yeah.
That's like why it's tolerable.
That's why that actually horrifies me more.
You're
in
right.
This film.
You are right.
And also,
it both makes it so that I can watch it, but also makes it break my soul.
Right. And then, you know, and ever so often, I always think, or at least after I've seen this movie, after it's mentioned, I always think about this fictitious guy that had to fuck her with the thing. Like, how's he doing? Like, what became of his mental state after the fact, you know? Like, oof.
Well, forced murder fucking aside, here are some more box office facts. Seven fell to third place in its fifth weekend behind two debuting films, Get Shorty and Now and Then. A total of 9 weeks in the top 10, earning $100.1 million, ninth overall for 1995. It was nominated for one Oscar, as I stumbled over my words in the last sentence. It was Best Editing. Robin, the winner that year?
95?
Mm-hmm.
Apollo 13.
Correct. Apollo 13 won Best Editing over Seven, Babe, Braveheart, and previous episode subject Crimson Tide. Was also nominated for one BAFTA. This time it was for Best Original Screenplay. Andrew Kevin Walker, as Camila mentioned. Lost to Usual Suspects. Speaking of things I want to get out of the way, sandwiched here in the middle of the facty segment. Listen, I know that he's awful and I want him to go away forever,
yes.
But the fact that Kevin Spacey did this and Usual Suspect in the same year, there are not many better acting years in history. Those right. are two perfect performances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he's a trash bag and it fucking sucks that this is who he is as a person, because it actually ruined a lot of good performances of his for me. There's like several movies I had to just like toss out of my collection. This is probably the only one that I've watched with him in it since all of that came out. So
I was saying to Colin, it's easier to watch him play this just completely despicable, broken soul.
Mm-hmm.
And you are not asked to sympathize with him at all.
Right.
Right. And so I can still watch it.
Yeah. As opposed to like,
yeah, look at the garbage man be a garbage character.
Right. As opposed to like him in The Ref or American, I guess American Beauty has got to be awful.
American Beauty is definitely the one where it's the most like.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah.
It was already questionable.
Which used to be one of my favorite movies. I'm pretty sure it's off the list now. Yeah. I mean, it's. And it doesn't age all that well to begin with. But
right.
Especially
I think people have been overly harsh on American Beauty's aging poorly. But it is in the trash bin because of Kevin Spacey now.
Yeah. And as Robin mentioned, winner of three MTV Movie Awards, including Best Movie, defeating Apollo 13, Braveheart, Clueless, and Dangerous Minds.
Justice for Clueless.
Yep. Maybe that's the thing. It was just a bunch of young heads that were going to see it. If it won Best Movie for MTV Movie Awards, that's probably what it was.
14-year-old white boy, this is the greatest thing that you could ever ask for.
Yeah. Okay. It's five movies chosen arbitrarily by the MTV, you know, big wigs. It's not Apollo 13. It's not Braveheart. Sorry. It's not Braveheart. And it's probably not Dangerous Minds. I've never seen Dangerous Minds. Which is the better movie, Seven or Clueless? I think that's a very close call.
It is. Team it's Clueless. Difficult because it for me, it all comes down to what mood am I in?
Right. Because, boy, that,
Bad double
feature.
If you're
in a clueless mood, 7 is not the right choice.
Right, exactly. And vice versa.
It also won Most Desirable Male for Brad Pitt. Alicia Silverstone won that year, of course. Best Villain, Kevin Spacey won Best Villain over Joe Pesci in Casino, yeah. John Travolta in Broken Arrow, yep. and both Jim Carrey and Tommy Lee Jones in Batman Forever.
Yep.
I don't really think of Joe Pesci's character in Casino as a villain.
It's just Joe Pesci.
Yeah.
When he does an album, he's the villain. You know?
If you talk to the cops and try to flee, your car will blow up when you turn the key. Don't cut a deal or have that case appeal. I keep my mouth shut and I never squeal. I'm a wise guy. I'm a wise guy.
So, teased it long enough about the ending. New Line requested a rewrite of the ending. The head in the box is pretty much the original ending that was in the script. New Line said, oh, definitely not, and made him write a pretty normal action sequence to conclude the film. But then, when they were trying to get Fincher to do it, because Fincher was very, like, moody and disillusioned at that point because of something having to do with Alien 3. Well,
I was gonna say, why was David Fincher not immediately put in lifetime director jail because of Alien Cubed?
I mean,
is it because he's a white man?
Well, yeah, he kind of was, but you know, they thought that he could do this, and they were right.
The fact that they had to fight to get him as opposed to vice versa doesn't make sense to me.
Well, when they sent the script, they accidentally sent the original script instead of their revised one. Mm. They accidentally sent the head in the box script instead of their one with a, you know, a normal, less bleak ending. And Fincher said, yes, absolutely, I'll do this. And that's when the pieces started falling into place. Later, when they realized their error, they were like, oh, no, we're not ending this with the protagonist's, or, you know, whatever, Brad Pitt's wife's head in a box and he kills and, it, you know, there's no happy, we're not doing that at all. And Fincher and Brad Pitt both said, we're walking if it's not the head in the box ending. And that is the only reason it got made the way it did.
It's excellent that because it would have been a completely, it would have been just another forgettable film had it ended like a normal, you know, without the head in the box and just like, oh, I'm going to chase John Doe throughout the desert and then eventually mm-hmm. like kill him. Or there's a fight, there's fisticuffs or whatever. Like it definitely just would have been like kind of a forgotten film, in my opinion.
They actually kept arguing, like, can it be a dog's head in the box?
Oh, God.
Bit where there's a dead dog and Kevin Spacey says, I didn't do that,
right.
is the best part of this whole movie.
They wanted Morgan Freeman to shoot him so that Brad Pitt didn't have to. Like,
oh,
they were like,
no.
angling for any layer where there could be a little tiny bit of redemption. And the only concession was it was supposed to end with Brad Pitt shooting Kevin Spacey, credits roll. And they tacked on another scene
that kind of implies
that Morgan Freeman is going to stick around and has that quote that's
Ernest Hemingway, the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. I agree with the second part is what mm-hmm. Morgan Freeman adds. I think that is the perfect final line of a movie.
Yeah.
And it makes this movie, it was what I was going to say before I was like, let's do the summary. That line existing makes me able to tolerate this movie more because, you know, sort of attaching to the, like, all of their conversations about, like, is the world garbage? Yes right. or no? Like, Colin and I have those conversations a lot. And before 2016, I was very much on the side of the world is not garbage. People are mostly good, yada, yada, yada. And the last 4 years of Hell on Earth have wavered me. I don't know where I really do land on the subject. This year in particular, it's like, oh, God, people are just awful. But still think the world is worth fighting for. And I think that having that, like, handhold helps me exist in the world of this movie. Mm. Does that make sense?
It does. I don't like it. There's no voiceover in this movie. Like, just structurally, it's not a movie with voiceover, so throwing it in at the end is like, wait, what? But also, it's like, I'm not convinced that Morgan Freeman would stick around and keep fighting if he was on the...
I think he was.
Yeah, I don't get the feeling that he stayed on the force. I feel like he may have added that from his bungalow in Cabo or whatever.
Right.
That's just him.
He said, I'll be around. implies not like I'm leaving for, well, I'm sure you're done now. Right. Nor would he think that the world is worth fighting for after, like, he was this close to the edge, and then his reward was he took a person under his wing, and look what happened. I think he's more dismayed than ever. I think a note of hope is false. I would lean in. I'd end it with Morgan Freeman shoots Brad Pitt to try to stop him from shooting Kevin Spacey, doesn't get it in time, and then shoots himself. Like, the level of pitch blackness this is, just putting a little scene of, like, I guess hope. Is like, no hope.
I need it. I'm weak.
I would have preferred it just end it with him shooting Kevin and, you know, that'd be it. That was like roll credits.
Yeah. A few bits of alternate casting. Morgan Freeman was no higher than the fourth choice.
Which is absurd. Right? He's perfect for this.
Apparently it came very close with Al Pacino, who turned it down for Steve Ball.
No. Yep. No. That would have been. Ugh.
Did he not do it because he was doing Heat?
He was doing City Hall.
Oh.
Yeah. Robert Duvall and Gene Hackman both turned the role down.
Gene
before it
Hackman.
Got to Morgan Freeman.
Oh my God. Also, I saw that like Denzel Washington was supposed to have Brad Pitt play Brad Pitt's role, but he but he was like, nope, this shit is too evil. I can't do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brad Pitt was no higher than the third pick. Denzel turned it down and Sylvester Stallone turned it down before they got to
Hallelujah. How do you
imagine this movie with Al Pacino and Sylvester Stallone?
Gross. Gross.
Denzel apparently did regret passing on it when he saw it. It was like, oh, that. Well, Christina Applegate turned down the Tracy role. Fine.
What? I like Christina Applegate.
Is this how Gwyneth Paltrow and Brad Pitt met?
I feel like they were already together when they did this.
Okay. Yeah.
The stunning thing is, before Fincher signed on, it was briefly attached to director Jeremiah Chechik, best known for National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. He was in line to do... I mean, he does a lot of different things. He also did Benny and June, and he did The Avengers, not the superhero one, the British TV adaptation with Uma Thurman. Yeah. So he is all over the place. But yeah, the Christmas Vacation guy was maybe going to do Seven with Al Pacino and Sylvester Stallone.
I mean, they both have a fairly bleak outlook.
Right?
Yeah.
It's just a lot better lighting in Christmas Vacation.
Yeah. One of my favorites. And finally, to end a protracted faxy segment, a check-in with the highly ridiculous IMDb all-time user rankings. According to the voters of IMDb, this is the 20th best movie ever made. It is an overall 8.6 out of 10 with more than 1.4 million votes. Number 20 all-time. Number one is still The Shawshank Redemption, because... the internet is basic.
Yeah, basic.
Listen, The Shawshank Redemption can stay there forever because it could be worse.
I'm just like,
like,
I mean,
that is a movie that it is totally fine for people to love. I just, because those ratings are just like so dominated by dark, sinister white male forces. Like, I don't know if you know about how The Hunt, that Danish movie, is like in their top 20.
The Hunt.
Okay, it is a movie about a guy who's falsely accused of sexual assault.
Oh.
And it's like, women lie and men are persecuted. Mads Mikkelsen's in it, and he's actually really good. Like, it's not a bad movie.
I've seen the fact advertisements.
That every time I see people say that they love The Hunt, I'm like chilled to the bone. I'm like, you have raped someone.
Yeah, you know that image that was going around Twitter of a dude's DVD collection?
Yes.
That's basically what we have here. It's the current ratings are Shawshank Redemption, followed by Godfather, followed by Godfather Part Two, then The Dark Knight, 12 Angry Men, appropriate. Huh. Schindler's List, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, Pulp Fiction, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, Fight Club, Forrest Gump, Inception, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, Empire Strikes Back, The Matrix, Goodfellas, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Seven Samurai, and then Seven is 20th.
None of those movies are about women.
Right. Or
about
people of color.
About women. Well, Silence of the Lambs, if you count it.
Okay, there you go. Yes, that does count.
Like, there's no
Spirited Away. It's 27.
There you go.
I can't even like tell you my favorite. Like, it would take me 2 months to come up with a list of my favorite 20 movies of all time. Like, let alone you just can't rank like of all time.
Right, and like when you say favorite, that's also another thing. It's right. Like, this movie is the most precious to
me. Right, right.
More so than I actually genuinely think this is the best movie ever. Who gets to decide that? Right. It's kind of folly. I think it's much more fun when we do more specific things, like what are your five favorite Brad Pitt performances? Like, right. That's something that I feel comfortable deciding.
Yes, exactly. Favorite villains, which John Doe definitely falls into one of my favorite fictional villains on the cinematic screen.
I'm really interested in his journaling.
They were somebody for real. Like, they paid somebody to do that, to fill out those journals. And it took them 2 months and they did. They paid a couple $1,000s or something for somebody to do it. But yeah, there are so many things like the set design of whoever like put together his apartment. Like, how long and what was the intricacies that went along with that? Like, that is like going deep inside of a mind of somebody that would do this. Like, how do you set that shit up?
Right.
And
the production design is so good because it has that. Everything feels dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Everything feels
wet, damp.
Yes. Yes. But it doesn't feel over the top. They really, like, I think a lot of things like 8mm, for example, feels over the top with that. And a lot of stuff that came in the wake of 7 really overdid it. This grittiness. It looks real while still being fantastically yucky.
Yeah.
One of my takeaways this time was this kind of shouldn't work. Like, you know, in addition to it being bleak, you know, it's a dark, dimly lit movie in a way that usually bothers me. It is full of like angry, oppressive sound. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, it's hard to hear very deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much that's like gross, not just the kills. Like you said, everything feels like it smells bad.
They're like, shaking house.
In so many movies, these elements combine to give you a really unpleasant time. Yet this is so good that it doesn't matter. It just all comes together.
Yeah. And I think the chemistry, like, luckily, like, all those other people bowed out or they weren't chosen or whatnot, because the chemistry between Brad and Morgan, it works very well. And it's not something that you would, it's not words that I would ever, normally you would think, oh yeah, that seems right. Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, they feel like they would flow well on screen together. They're so believable as, you know, Somerset, the grizzled old, you know, disenfranchised cop who's like ready to get the fuck out of there. And then Brad's like the eager puppy. He's like, hey, put me in, coach. And he's like, you know, and they're, you know, arguing about the state of the world and the state of things and the state of man all the time. But then eventually they come to the grounds of that. Okay. Yeah, I get, like, I forget what scene it was, but where Morgan's like, this is for the first time ever, you and I fully agree on this one thing, that this is not the dude. This is not it. Also, this, before I forget, like, this is, and I mentioned, like, them being able to keep it quiet. You know, they didn't put Kevin Spacey in any of the promo stuff, and they didn't put him, what he was supposed to be, like, top billed or something, but he was like, nope, I think it's going to work better if you keep my name out of it. This is, like, one of the best reveals in a film, and like to this day, just like still to this day, I know it's coming, I know who it is, and everything, but I'm still just like, ah, like I get goosebumps when
it's a cool goosebumps moment.
What I was going to say when we were talking about Christina Applegate and Gwyneth Paltrow was that, like, after watching it so many times, and I now see, like, she's only there for, like, we should have called it, like, you could have been able to call it, like, way early, that, oh yeah, she's gonna end up dead, because she has no other real purpose in this film. And then, like, that point, like, after, once John Doe is seen on screen, his wife is mentioned 3 times. That's the most, like, she's pretty much mentioned, like, throughout the film. And it's just like, oh, here we go, here it is. And we should have all known at that point.
Can we talk about that scene with her and Morgan Freeman?
I was like, are you trying to fuck, girl?
Listen, Morgan Freeman, I would punch him in his perfect face if I was like, I'm pregnant and I don't know what to do, and he was like, well, let me tell you about me and my former partner and how we got pregnant, and I pressured her to get an abortion, and I feel bad about it, and don't tell Brad Pitt, and man, right. Pregnancies are only valid to the extent that they emotionally influence men.
I'm sorry, why did I call you? Like, what was the
right? Get some friends.
Well, it would have been good if instead they had written, you know, a fucking relationship between Brad and Gwyneth, which is not in there at all.
No.
You know, I think he cares more about the dogs.
Oh, God. He was so excited to see him.
But not only that, like, hey, let's get this under, like, if we're not going to write the female character at all. Let's get this under 2 hours by knocking out the pregnancy subplot altogether. Like, one, it was icky, especially in that scene. Two, like, are you telling me he wasn't going to shoot him until he revealed the thing that she was pregnant? Like, oh, when you cut off my wife's head and put it in a box and brought it to me, I was keeping it together. But she was pregnant, now I'm going to shoot you. Like, I don't think...
could have been a boy, Sean.
I don't see it as such. I think it was just like the extra thing. Like, he was already teetering on the edge and he probably would have shot him anyway. But it was just like, you know, this is it. And just like even the fucking reaction shot of that. When after Somerset smacks him and he realizes, oh, you didn't know. Like, just fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Just for that alone. And you're right. We could have cut out her scene, her talking to Morgan and all that shit. And that still would have landed like for the audience the audience didn't need to know beforehand that she was pregnant. Like, we could have all been surprised along with Brad. It would have been fine.
I think it would have felt cheap. Her being pregnant is cheap. Period.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, those elements kind of dinged it a little on this viewing for me. But the thing that brought it back up was sitting there and going, oh, wait, Brad Pitt is the bad guy in this movie. I think, you know, Kevin Spacey is the best villain at the MTV Movie Awards. But in the narrative structure of this movie, he is almost incidental. It's a movie about Morgan Freeman trying to get Brad Pitt to, you know, be a good person, but also to see the world in an honest way. There's so much in there about, don't just call him crazy. Right. It's reductive and not useful to you to just call him crazy. You need to actually try to understand things. You need to see the complexities and understand what's going on around you. That's the narrative thrust of the movie, is Morgan Freeman teaching Brad Pitt. And he won't do it, and he won't do it, and he keeps saying, no, he's just crazy, he's a nut, he's dancing around in his own feces. Right. And then, surprise! Yeah, that's what happened. He couldn't be saved, and he killed the suspect, who is kind of, certainly a co-antagonist, not a great guy, but like, in terms of the structure of this movie, John Doe is the complicating factor, Brad Pitt is the bad guy. That's what I really liked about it this time.
And I kind of feel
like...
Are we
meant to believe that Brad Pitt goes to jail for this?
I don't know. I always wonder about that. Like, I feel like no. Like, he doesn't.
I mean, this was a more naive time when it was, you know, there wasn't a whole flag out there dedicated to the idea that cops get to murder anyone who they feel like.
He could have pled insanity, like, absolutely. Temporary insanity.
Like, there's like jury nullification issues happening there also. Right. Like, and I just think he'd get away with it. I also think it is so fucking funny that they act like it's this horrifying secret that the government knows what you take out from the library.
Right, right.
This movie predicted the Patriot Act. Isn't that fun? It's like 6 years later when they were like, yeah, we're just going to do that. Maybe we were and maybe we weren't the whole time. You'll never know, but now it's legal. Thanks.
And like, we can't possibly tell the judge why we're here. It's this dark secret that no one can know.
Right. Also, to like add on to your point, Sean, about Brad Pitt being the bad guy, that whole scene, the whole ride out to the desert, it's like Brad is being set up. Like, he's just talking and talking and talking all this nonsense and just being like real smug, real like glove with him, and just real dismissive and talking about how crazy and insane he is. And but it's like, yeah, but you know, when he says something like, you're gonna remember me, or you're gonna be remembered because of me, that's where we end up.
And he's undercutting the whole you know, Morgan Freeman is doing his level best to work John Doe in a proper dealing with a suspect, dealing with a you know, whatever. He's doing the right things. And John Doe is working Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt is letting it happen.
Yeah.
It's Brad Pitt's the bad guy.
I like that theory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's also, and I always kind of, these kind of things, like when you have a serial killer that has a quote unquote purpose, or, you know, he's sending a message or whatnot. You know, you sometimes you find yourself, hey, you're not wrong, but it's not, but maybe you don't go about it this way, but I get what you're saying. Whereas to where like the cop, the lawyer was concerned and sloth, like, I had to cover, that fucked me up hard. Like the first time I saw it, and I have to cover my eyes to this day to when sloth is introduced.
It's so upsetting. And I forgot how much they foreshadow that in the beginning with Brad Pitt being like, well, did you make sure that he's still alive? He's actually dead.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The extras in the room, or rather all the actors who weren't Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, didn't know that was going to happen. It was one of those.
Oh, God.
They thought this was just a body and a corpse, and then he did the thing.
Oh, not Dr. Cox. How did Dr. Cox respond to that?
Yeah. Nobody told Dr. Cox.
Which, that's one of the, I think it's him that delivers it, but one of the final lines is after, well, not the final lines, but after he shoots John Doe, here's the guy in the helicopter. Oh, my God. Call somebody. Somebody call somebody.
I'm like, who you gonna call?
Well, what a fitting conclusion to a year when, for all of us, John Doe had the upper hand. Whoever your John Doe was in 2020.
John Doe has the upper hand. John Doe has the upper hand.
Let's rate it. Camila, go first.
95.
Woo!
Ooh.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember if there was something I was taking a point away for. No, I give it an 87. I had to end in 7. It either had to be in the 70s or it had to end in 7. So it's an 87. Robin?
I am going to be the anchor on this one with a conservative 74.
Okay. I mean, it's no shock as to what that is. This, I would be the highest vote, but it's just like, just to be clear, I just like to put it out there slow because I'm not one of those, you know, disillusioned, oh my God, this is like one of the yada yada yada, like the reasonings behind my extremely high score is, like, you know, like I said, the chemistry between Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow could have like fucking died in a fucking fire, whatever, like she could burn in hell, but like the way this is written, the fact that we don't see the actual kills on screen, the score in itself, like
really good.
Yeah, it's like you're rooted in gloom and doom for like the entire 2 hours, basically. And it just stays with me. Really stayed with me. And again, like that reveal of Kevin Spacey as John Doe, it just sticks to me. And it's just like, as far as filmmaking goes, this is one of the very, very good ones, like very well, very great example of how you get that psychological thriller in there.
I'm really happy that it got an editing nomination because I was noticing a lot, like even like the chase scene.
Yeah.
It's like so propulsive and gripping. And it's just people running down hallways and alleyways and falling off fire escapes. Like, it's nothing special.
Right. Exactly. And that's another thing. Like, I'm usually like, you know, a lot of times I fall into the category of like, oh, sometimes like really flashy editing. I'm kind of cheap that way sometimes. I'm a little bit of a flashy editing whore. It's like, oh, that's a great movie. But this has none of that. It's great editing, but it's not like Smoking Aces, that type of editing. Right. Yeah.
Camila ties her personal high score, a 95, same score that you gave Purple Rain.
Oh, did I? Interesting.
I don't know if I've given anything. I don't know if I've gone above 93. Robin went to 96 for, I'm going to just say Speed without looking it up.
I think it was Speed.
Pretty sure it's Speed. So one of the highest individual scores we've ever received, and certainly among our high-ranking films, it lands at an 85 and one-third, 85 and change for 7. That seems good.
Yeah, that's fair.
I think that the bingo card comes back next week, yeah?
That's correct.
Well, that means it's time for You Can't Handle the Truth. We talked a while about 7, so we won't do all of the many movies I'm sure we've watched over the last week. I'm sorry to push both myself and Camila aside, but boy, the headline today is Robin watched Tenet.
I didn't watch Tenet.
Yeah, I didn't watch anything anyway, so.
Oh, okay. It's fine. I enjoyed it more than Mank.
Okay.
No, I enjoyed Mank a bit more. But okay. Go ahead.
You know, like, they fight and Robert Pattinson smiles, which I'm not sure I've ever seen, at least like in a scene where he's not masturbating. And it never made sense. I found it like literally physically exhausting trying to make it make sense.
Yep.
And then when I started watching 7 after it, I had this moment of like, well, wait, is he going forwards or backwards? And I was like, well, clearly I need to take a break. Because in normal movies, everyone is going forwards.
Oh.
I don't think that it is good for a movie to be that hard to understand. So, like, that makes me think that Tenet is a bad movie. And yet, like, I enjoyed watching it. So I don't think that Tenet is a bad movie. I do know for damn sure that it was better watching it at my house so we could periodically pause and go, what do you think is happening right now?
Yeah, there are movies that deliberately don't have answers. Fine. Artsy. I think Arrival is like if Tenet were done well, where like you do have to do some work to figure out exactly what's going on.
I also did not like Arrival.
Okay.
I was like, this is dumb. I don't understand it. It doesn't make me feel things because I'm too busy not understanding it.
And I disagree because it's a sad space movie. Please see several other episodes. But to me, in Arrival, it was rewarding to work out what was going on and consider it. In Tenet, you could do all of the work of figuring out what the hell is happening and putting the timelines together. And if you do, you'd go, oh, okay. Like, there's no reward for the incredible labor you have to do to make sense of it.
Yeah. The other thing I think is missing is just character. Right. You know, like we've talked before about how Inception doesn't make any sense, that I don't care. I really enjoy that movie because they, you know, collect a nice little group of interesting people who I enjoy watching. And I don't know what the hell's going on with Marion Cotillard, but I am interested in it.
Right.
Whereas John David Washington's character is literally called the protagonist and is nothing. He is a total cipher. And it's a common problem with secret agent movies where it's like, oh, their whole job is to not have an identity. And it's like, but it's a movie.
Right.
Give them a personality.
Boo.
Please. Like, James Bond would be a bad spy, but he's a good movie character, and that's what we're going for.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Is anyone memorable in this movie, in Tenet? I mean, I like
Kenneth
Elizabeth Debicki,
but that's... memorably embarrassing.
Yeah. I just love Elizabeth Debicki. That's what's going on there.
Very tall.
She's well-dressed. Everyone's well-dressed.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, I think this is one of those cases where a lot of people want to be like, Tenet's not very good. And no one's really arguing the other side. Some people are like, I liked it a lot, but they're not like coming to war. They're like, well, I enjoyed it and shying away. So anything else?
Oh, I watched the first 10 minutes of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and decided that I was too drunk to appreciate it properly. And I'm looking forward to finishing it at some point this weekend.
Right.
Because in those 10 minutes, I was like, yep, I'm on board. I like what's happening. These performances are working for me. I'm into it.
Yeah, I need to make sure I'm in a great, great place. Like that I can really like get in there. That's what I've been waiting for.
Nothing to contribute, Camila? Not been looking at screens as much?
Just a lot, just TV shows, and I don't even know. Maybe there's been a lot of Christmas stuff that's been on the TV screen, so I think that's basically it. We've just been, you know, watching my daughter likes a lot of music videos. I've been showing her a lot of music videos from Ricky Martin.
Yes!
She likes Ricky Martin.
Dude, she... I think
that in the episode description.
I think that... I didn't know if I had told you guys yet, but I have found out that I'm pretty sure Ricky Martin is her first crush, because there's like one song that like she'll be running around, doing her thing. I put on this video of Pigate, him singing live, and she stops. And like the other day, she like straight up stopped. She grabbed her binky. She grabbed her blanket. She went and sat down on the beanbag chair, which she never does. And the other day, Dan showed her a different Ricky Martin video, and she says, pretty. So...
this is too cute. It hurts.
My kid larves Ricky Martin.
I love that. Thank you.
Fantastic.
That is the story I needed to lift my spirits after watching Seven.
Yes.
The world is a good place.
All right.
If toddlers can fall in love with Ricky Martin, it's worth fighting for. I loved Pixar's Soul. This might be the best Pixar movie. I won't go back and check because, you know, Pixar movies are such an experience that's like, nobody needs to be put through that ringer. But, you know, thinking back, I feel as good about it as I feel about WALL-E or Inside Out one, it's really funny. Like, this isn't like normal, ah, an amusing children's film, ha ha ha, like throwing my head back, laugh out loud funny a lot. Wow. During Soul, it's visually, you know, I know I shouldn't be surprised because they've done it several times before, but whenever Pixar is like, we're gonna make up an entire new visual language and create characters out of lines and dots that are perfect, it's amazing every time, and really the case here. And the subject matter is so good and so well taken. Like, yeah, it's kind of existential and, you know, what does it all mean, but like it adds up to be, you know, about trying to find your purpose in life, and kind of has the message that the purpose of life is living life, and you don't need to find a thing to drive you. It's life itself that drives you, and man, did I need that right now.
Yeah.
The cast is good and funny. Jamie Foxx and Tina Fey are both great. I loved it. I am highly, highly recommend, especially if it's, since it's coming for free to Disney Plus, not even the premium kind. It is just going to drop on Disney Plus this Friday.
Yay.
Throw that on over your holiday weekend, please.
I wonder if they're ever going to do another one of those.
What?
Like what they did with Mulan. Like, was that a one-time experiment?
I saw somewhere that might happen for, is it Raya and the Last Dragon? Might be that.
Oh, okay, sure.
They might abandon that. We don't know how well it worked for Mulan. And if it worked great for Mulan, they'd probably be doing it for Soul. So,
exactly.
I don't know. Yeah. I won't give it away here because that's a whole other subject, but at PittsburghMagazine.com and certainly on my Twitter at SeanCollierPGH, by the time you see this, you hear this, it's a podcast, you can find my top 10 of the year, which felt different this year.
Yeah. I haven't seen enough movies to feel confident that I could do a fair top 5. And I don't know when I'm going to. Like, after the new year, like, I feel so fragile right now. And it's so weird to me that I normally at this time of year am like, watching heavy Oscar bait like almost every day.
Yeah.
And I had this moment of like, would I be doing better if I were still watching sad movies every day? And then I realized I would be doing better if I could do that safely at a movie theater, but I cannot. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm gonna keep on watching sitcoms and playing Animal Crossing.
Yeah, I've watched a lot of them. I have not watched everything that you should watch, but that's the case every year.
Yeah.
There's something hollow about that this year. Like, when I see a lot of movies that are very, very good, but maybe not perfect, and I'm just like, yes, this is another very good movie, that's less effective for me right now than it would be in a normal year. So much more of my list this year is stuff that I saw a while ago. Including number one and number two, I saw at least 4 or 5 months ago. There's a couple. Soul is in my top five. Minari, which we'll talk about when it gets closer, is in my top five. But it's an interesting list for that reason, because it's not like all of the obvious subjects. But right. But yeah, it's a weird year to be like, isn't Nomadland great? Like, I don't know. Probably. I don't care. It's, yeah, she's living in a van. Yeah, that would be bad. It's a bleak world. You know, it's, you got to be different to stand out this year. Maybe that's the theme of my list. Things that are a little bit different.
Yeah, I think my list would just be a bunch of newer to me stuff. Like, there's not a lot of stuff that was released this year that I saw. So it's just be, I mean, there's some stuff on my list that I really enjoyed, but a lot of it was like released in 2018 or 2019.
I'm going to end up, according to my Twitter count, having watched 400 different movies this
year.
That's
really cool. Wow. That's my like only New Year's resolution, other than like survive, is actually keep track of the movies that I watch this year, because the last 2 years I've given up at different points in the year because things got hard for different reasons.
Right.
And I hate not having that record, because I want to be able to go sort, and I want to think about, you know, was this one better than that one? And I need to organize my thoughts in spreadsheet form, or at least Letterboxd.
Yeah, at least do your Letterboxd, man.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just did it on Twitter this year, and that felt fine because then I could, you know, people would reply and I would chat a little bit.
Yeah.
But Letterboxd feels like a spreadsheet I'm not getting paid to make. You know, it's like clerical work.
It's so much easier. Which, by the speaking of Twitter, I have a question. Like, could you please explain your GIF for this movie, when your redacted GIF?
Everyone was like, you're watching Clerks, and I didn't want to give the no, the GIF is never from the movie speech. Right. It's a GIF of Dante finding an inferno.
Oh my god, so deep. It's deep, man.
The beginning of Clerks 2, when the character Dante opens the
right
quick stop gate and finds it's on fire. It is literally Dante's Inferno.
Look at the big brain on Brad.
And people are like, wait, I don't get it. I'm like, well, I'm not going to explain it because right, then right. I look like the dick. To be clear, I'm probably the dick, but no,
it's,
it was
it's
good.
Brilliant. That's what it's there for, man. You got to get in the thinkers.
Crimson Tide, still the best. The waterfall, elevator blood from The Shining. It's yes. a Crimson Tide.
Yes.
Hey, let's draw a movie. We haven't done that in a while.
Yeah.
So a bingo card next week, Vito's return next week, but no one has any vetoes. Nothing is unusual. This is just drawing a movie. This is just drawing a movie, and whatever it is, we gotta watch it.
Talk us through it, Sean.
Number is 809. Good news, Nicolas Cage.
Ooh, okay. Interesting.
Bad, not so great news, but maybe fun. Nicolas Cage in National Treasure.
Oh, we cool. Will...
I've never seen it. That'll be interesting.
I love this movie.
All right.
Oh, okay. I don't remember it well enough to have an opinion, so great.
It's like, on Disney Plus also, I think.
Oh, cool.
I think that's right. In my mind, it's The Mummy, but without a mummy. Like, that's what's in my head. Or the Da Vinci Code without delusions of grandeur. You know?
It's both of those things.
Well, this will be good. Nick Cage.
What a way to kick off 2021 with maybe there's a secret solution to problems somewhere. It's hidden. On the back of the thing. My clearest memory of this was, I feel like this was right after I started at, I was working at a movie theater at the time, and this was a big multiplex where there's like 700 seats. Things almost never sold out. And on a Friday or Saturday night over the holiday, it was like, oh shit, National Treasure is sold out. Because it was like, hey, bring the whole family, have a good time.
I saw National Treasure in a sold out theater, and I'm going to save it for next week, but... Me and my group of friends laughed at a particular moment in this film so loudly and obnoxiously that we got collectively shushed.
Oh, wow.
I look forward to trying to pick out what the moment was as I watch National Treasure. No, that's fun. Good way to kick off the year. Before we get there, though, Seven was released September 22nd, 1995. What was the number one song in America when a head got put in a box?
Mariah Carey.
What did Camila say?
Mariah Carey.
No, it was close. It was close to being 3 weeks in a row. If it had been a little earlier or later, it would have been just Mariah Carey for the third consecutive episode. But no, Robin's correct. It's Gangsta's Paradise.
Oh, wow.
That was like that whole year, right?
I think so. It was on,
it was the
all
best-selling
the
single of the year.
On, yeah, when you mentioned Dangerous Minds, I was like, oh, I have a guess.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen Dangerous Minds.
Oh, I've seen it. It's not worth it. It's a really
it's not worth it.
It's not okay. worth it. I mean, like, have you seen Lean on Me?
I have.
That's all you need. Just leave it at that.
I haven't seen it either. My clearest memory of Dangerous Minds is telling my parents that I wanted the Dangerous Minds soundtrack on cassette for Christmas. This was passed off as the thing for my godmother to get. And so she came over and handed me the cassette, and we all saw that it had a parental advisory sticker on it, so I was not permitted to listen to it.
So you had a gift that you could not then enjoy?
That's true. Did they take it away or just trust that you weren't going to listen to it?
The fear of God was in me at that point. For some reason, it's probably the fear of God since I was raised Catholic, that like there are certain like lines you do not cross, and like illicitly taking in something that has been forbidden was one of those. So it just sat on the shelf.
Till you're 18.
Thank you, Tipper Gore.
On your 18th birthday, you cracked that baby open and had a party.
I don't think I got back to it. I'm going to go listen to it right now.
That's what's happening here.